So, Kate, today's conversation is a really interesting conversation with Dr. Paul...
Elwood.
And how do you know Dr. Paul?
So, he is a lecturer from one of the universities here in Adelaide.
Right.
And I was fortunate enough to sit through a couple of his units of study while I've been studying.
As part of your master's?
Yes.
Yeah, fantastic. It's a long conversation, it's technical, but it's really interesting, isn't it?
It is. So Paul's had a long career in evaluation, evaluating lots of different programs, including education. So we're taking a look at evaluation from an educational standpoint.
Mm-hmm. I found it quite interesting where Paul references the fact that the university has recently introduced peer assessment within the faculty, and that's something we do quite regularly within our organisation. Obviously, he talks about the importance of student feedback and the strengths and the weaknesses of those processes, action-based evaluation. Importantly, some accountability issues associated with evaluation. All really interesting. And I found one key point quite noteworthy is the triangulation of evidence, using different methods and different angles to ensure that your determinations are accurate.
And he has a really great way of describing why you do that.
Yeah. Towards the end, so it's worth listening in because towards the end he also then, Kate, prizes out of him the importance of his teaching ethos, which everyone has their own perspective, and that's also great listening, I think.
Welcome to this week's episode of Education Transformation, hosted by Lee and Kate Ridge. In this episode, we're looking at evaluation in education, and our guest is Dr. Paul Aylward. Paul has been working as a principal evaluation consultant for his own business, Action Research Partnerships, and as an academic and educator for over 25 years. Paul has evaluated 100 plus diverse government and NGO health programs and interventions. A qualified teacher, Paul has supervised several PhD students to completion, has written, coordinated, and taught postgraduate evaluation topics in public health and primary health care in universities in Australia and the UK. And he has developed several popular evaluation resources used by government and non-government agencies here and overseas. Paul was the tri-statewide coordinator for the Primary Healthcare Research and Evaluation Development Program for several years at the University of Adelaide Department of General Practice, building capacity in evaluation across the healthcare sector, specialising in work with vulnerable groups, for example, suicide prevention, addiction, Aboriginal mental health, and currently families experiencing mental health issues. Paul has been awarded the National Commendation for Excellence in Evaluation Study by the Australasian Evaluation Society for his work in refugee mental health. So Paul, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. Just as a way of introduction, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, you know, anything about your jobs, and where you've come from?
Okay, right. Well, first of all, I come from Liverpool in the UK, as you may have gathered, right? I've been in Australia now since 2000.
A little while.
So that's kind of 20-odd years, really. So yeah, my background, well, really, it's a mixture of consultancy work, conducting evaluations in public health and primary health care mostly, though I have dabbled in other areas as well. And I've been involved in academia for probably about 30 years, maybe, something like that. Sometimes full-time. When I was in the UK, I was a full-time academic. But since being in Australia, I've always been part-time. I've worked in all three South Australian universities at different times. And at the same time, I run my own consultancy called Action Research Partnerships. So I've done quite a lot of evaluation work, mostly with vulnerable groups and vulnerable communities. So I've done some work with Aboriginal communities, refugee groups, injecting drug users and groups like that. I'm currently involved in quite a long program called the ACORN Parenting Program, which is a program for mums with mental health problems who have difficulties forming relationships with their children. So that program is essentially a two-pronged program which is looking both to address the mental health of these mums and also to improve their parenting relationship with the child. And that's been going for quite a long time. That's about 6 years now for me, which is very long.
Yes.
But that's an action research program, so I'm kind of working with the people delivering the program. That's funded by the Hopscotch Foundation. It's a wonderful program. It's really kind of uplifting to be involved in that program, to be honest. I'm working at Flinders University. I've been here now for the last probably 5 years, maybe 6 years, where I'm a senior lecturer here. I'm part-time, obviously, because of the consultancy work, and I specialise in teaching health promotion and teaching program planning and evaluation.
Probably leads us on quite nicely to, you know, the topic of this podcast is around evaluation, and specifically in education. Perhaps you could tell us about some evaluation projects you've worked on.
It's difficult to know where to start, to be honest, because I've done so many. Because when I was in the UK, I did a fair bit of consultancy work for what was then called the Health Education Authority, which was the main body overseeing health promotion and health education in the UK. It was based in London. So I worked on quite a number of different programmes there, mostly around sort of young people and smoking and exercises, things like that. I did a little bit of work early on looking at the British Sexual Attitudes and Behaviour Survey, although it was a fairly minor role in that one because it's still quite young. Moving on from there, over here I was, for a while, I was what was called the tri-statewide coordinator for a thing called PHC Red, which is Primary Healthcare Research Evaluation Development. And that covered Northern Territory, South Australia, and parts of Victoria. And that the work around there was actually looking to build capacity in evaluation amongst GP practices and allied health workers and things. So it kind of got me involved in quite a number of programmes around GP work. I was based in the School of General Practice at University of Adelaide at that time. So I did a fair bit of work with GPs, quite a difficult group to work with GPs in terms of recruitment, really, because they're so busy is the problem with GPs, really. What else have I done? Difficult to know where to start, really. I did stuff on COPD with GPs. It was a specific one, and also there was some work I did with a guy called Dr. Oliver Frank over there, who put together some software for patients called Patients Information Sheets, whereby the patient would arrive at the GP and given a kind of brief of their past medical history and what future sort of treatments they should be looking to discuss with the GP and things, which was a program around that. I've done a lot of work in the drug area. So I evaluated the peer education program, which was based on the Clean Needle program in South Australia. So that was mostly sort of current and former injecting drug users working on that program, who are sort of manning the Clean Needle program in South Australia, which was a wonderful program to try and stop the spread of HIV and other blood-borne viruses, very successfully in the case of HIV, a little bit less successfully in the case of Hep C for a number of different reasons. I've also worked on mental health programs, the refugee stuff, particularly the big one was a thing called the Evaluation of the Reciprocity in Education program, which is a terrible name, I've always thought, but nonetheless. And that one
certainly
was
a mouthful.
Particularly if your refugee doesn't speak English, and but that was looking at refugees from different time period. So there was Italians were the kind of oldest refugees coming to Australia. And then we also had Cambodians and then Persian refugees are the most recent ones. Mm-hmm. And the idea of that programme was to try to really sort of tailor mental health programmes towards the needs of these groups of people. And in the process of doing so, that kind of redefined depression in terms which are more easily understood by these different cultural groups. That was done with a fellow called Professor Nicholas Proctor, who's based in University of South Australia. That was really interesting one, that, because what happened with that is that we got together groups of the refugee groups who put together composite stories, which were stories about the refugee experience and depression and sadness, profound senses of sadness, which comprised of all true elements from different people. So it kind of is a fictitious person, but all of the story was kind of true. And that was then presented to health professionals who designed interventions to deal with those groups, those composite stories. And it was an iterative process then whereby the intervention could be critiqued by the refugee group, and it kind of went back and forward and things. And for that one, I got an award from the Australasian Evaluation Society.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a long time ago now. That was for excellence in evaluation. So that was quite a nice meaty one. And lots of things like that. So lots of there's so many, to be honest.
It sounds very diverse. So let's perhaps look at evaluation more specifically. So what are the purposes of evaluation? So not just in education, but sort of across the board. Why do we evaluate programs?
Well, so the traditional way of looking at evaluation really is there's three main purposes of evaluation, basically. You can address evaluation from the accountability perspective, which is that we evaluate a program. I mean, well, all evaluation is about establishing the worth or value of a program.
Yeah. Right?
So that's what makes it different from research, pure research. And I have had differences of opinion around this with various academics. But the thing about evaluation is it's always geared towards establishing the value or worth of something. So there's a kind of judgment thing happening here, which in lots of other research, that's not necessarily the case. Some research is purely about gathering knowledge. Now, having said that, there are three general perspectives in evaluation. The first one is the accountability one, which is basically that the program is may be accountable to different groups, and the evaluation is holding the program to account.
Yeah.
Right? And the obvious one would be, say, for the funding bodies.
Yeah.
Although I do think funding bodies, in terms of what they look for, particularly key performance indicators and things like that, tend to be fairly simple indicators, really. And evaluation should really be trying to look a lot more at the meanings people attach to what's happening and try and understand things a bit better, in my view, anyway.
Yeah.
So you have the accountability perspective. The second view is really this thing around knowledge development, which makes a far closer overlap with the research, pure research, really. In that evaluation is about sort of looking at programs in order to generate knowledge about how the program works, what works for whom and in what circumstances, which is a kind of a branch of evaluation called realist evaluation. But really to try to generate new knowledge which can benefit future programs as well as the existing program perhaps, or just further knowledge generally. The purpose of it is basically knowledge generation.
Yeah.
And academics like that sort of thing because it can lead to publications and things. And the third approach, which is the one that that I've always favoured, right, is really about programme improvement. Okay, and that is that you evaluate in tandem with the delivery of the programme, basically in order to feed back information about what's working, the value of what's working for whom and in what circumstances, but you feed that back in a kind of continuous loops. And that way, you can improve the program as it progresses, really. And that's the kind of view I always try to adopt now. I used to do what are called summative evaluations, which tie in a lot more with the accountability perspective, where you do the evaluation at the end of the program and you say, well, you know, was it good or not? Yeah. Did it work or not? Which I always found totally unrewarding, to be honest. And particularly if, you know, you identify things which clearly could have been rectified had they been identified earlier. Mm. And unfortunately, you come towards the end of a program, some daft things, you know, and you think, why didn't you do that? So it's not very rewarding, that. It also creates a lot of kind of suspicion. Mm-hmm. Amongst the people you're doing the evaluation with, people, maybe the service providers or the people running the program. So you get off to the wrong, on the wrong start, really. You start on the wrong foot, I should say. So you right away, you're almost in a conflict situation between people who are concerned about what the evaluation might reveal and concerned about the outcomes of the evaluation in terms of funding or whatever, or even just reputation, right? And things like that. So you're kind of an outsider. And right away, you're in difficulty, really trying to get to the nitty gritty of what's making this thing work or not, right? Whereas the improvement perspective, the kind of action research perspective, or participatory action research perspective, is that you form the partnerships with the people delivering the program, which is the participatory element of action research. So right away from the start, you try to engage with the people delivering the program, so you have a synergy of expertise, right? So basically, they can provide the inside information about the program and teach the evaluator about how it's supposed to work and things like that, and the evaluator can basically build a bit of capacity in the organization amongst the service providers around evaluation as well. But the idea is that you're working in partnership, so you're moving, rowing together and moving forward together in order to improve the program, because most people involved in these things, particularly with vulnerable groups, which is the groups I'm more interested in, they're already committed, right? You start off from the premise that people want the program to work for these people. Yeah. Quite often they're not on very good wages, they're not there for the money. So if you can get people on board in partnership and say, look, you know, identifying things that work and work well is fantastic, but it's also important and beneficial to identify things that don't work well.
Yeah.
And if we do that, then we can address, because problems are not resolvable unless they've been identified as problems. Mm. Okay, so I'm whittling on here, is that
no,
okay?
No, it's
okay.
Great.
Right, okay.
So have you found over time that the focus of evaluation has changed? You know, sort of earlier on, did you find that more of the summative evaluations were being asked for as opposed to participatory and improvement focus?
That's a difficult one to call, to be honest, because I mean, I think the first of all, if you have programs which are short-term funded, right? So you still get a lot of programs which are, say, funded for a year, maybe 2 years, The action research elements becomes much more difficult to implement because there's less time.
Yeah.
Right. And I think probably in Australia, I think particularly evaluations and research, for that matter, done on as opposed to with Aboriginal communities, has kind of suffered from this quite a bit, because that sort of work usually necessitates and requires quite a long period of time of basically just establishing relationships, developing some kind of trust and rapport with the communities, identifying who to speak to, what permissions are needed and things like that. And that eats into the time of the funding.
Yeah.
So consequently, you kind of have less time for the program to get up and running properly and to be evaluated, really. So that was one of the things that happened when I was the tri-statewide coordinator for PHC Red, actually, because that was one of the things that was happening under that program, is that evaluations and some research was being funded, but for very short periods of time. Like you started off as a year, and then later on, because of, I like to think anyway, because of the arguments around, you know, the difficulties, particularly doing research with Aboriginal communities, that then got extended for a long period of time, a couple of years. So anyway, getting back to your point, so yeah, I mean, I think if you have shorter term ones, it's much more difficult to do that kind of action research type work. I think you've also still got the dominant business model applied to evaluation, really, in that a lot of people push the idea that, you know, what we're interested in is outcomes here.
Yeah.
Have the outcomes been achieved or not? Now, that is, it kind of doesn't fit that well. I mean, it should, really, but in some ways it doesn't fit that well with the more kind of participatory, identify weaknesses and try and address them type of approach. It fits much better with kind of what are sometimes called black box evaluations, where, you know, you're not really interested in what's happening inside the black box of the programme. What you're interested in is looking at the inputs going in, how much we're investing, and what's being produced at the end of it. And I think that's still a pretty dominant kind of model, really, in evaluation. Certainly it's dominant model, I think, in a lot of health research, which is still dominated by this randomised control trial type approaches, which, I mean, this is expanding a lot more recently, where people are beginning to look more about, you know, why people participate in randomised control trials, for example, and motivations behind it, what sorts of people are there, and the meanings they attach to the behaviour, things like that, as to kind of supplement the randomised control trial. But essentially, the randomised control trials are about looking at outcomes, okay, and controlling for all the concomitant variables to make sure that the only thing you're going to, the only difference you're going to get in the dependent variable is due to a manipulation of the independent variable. So they're still much more, that still, I think, is still pretty well a dominant model. In community health and work with vulnerable groups, that's much less so. Certainly less so in with work with Aboriginal communities, because I think the lessons have been learnt in Australia that, you know, applying certain approaches to work in, on Aboriginal communities is wrong, really, and doesn't really help. Funny, I remember, this was quite a long time ago, I remember being in Alice Springs and talking to some Aboriginal guys there, and they had a Aboriginal word there for white researchers coming into Alice Springs doing research on people, and some of those people could still remember white researchers, you know, measuring the circumference of the heads of their aunties and dividing people up and all this on some quack science nonsense. And they had this word for researchers which translated as seagulls. Was it seagulls? There was two. There was one in Darwin was seagulls, I think, but one, no, the one in Alice Springs was dried leaves, I think it was. Was that they blow in from nowhere, make a big mess of everything, and then blow away and you never see them again. That sort of thing, right? And they actually told me that they used to spin yarns for white researchers, so they would make up stories so they could go away and write up the PhDs and things. So there's a long history there, because you know, we don't operate in hermetically sealed environments, and you know, there's contextual and historical differences and influences in how people react to evaluation and react to research generally.
So with more of the participatory evaluation, you know, you're looking at making changes earlier on in the program as you identify either things that aren't working well or things that are perhaps going well and we want to keep doing those.
Yeah.
By the time you get to sort of the end of the program, as opposed to a summative evaluation, are your outcomes actually going to be more productive or more likely to be achieved because you've made changes early on rather than waiting to the end?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've done quite a bit of stuff, because I also, evaluation missed out there. I evaluated the South Australian component of the National Suicide Prevention Campaign. Right, this is going back a little bit. And in that, that was a cluster evaluation because there was lots of individual programs going on all around South Australia, right? And because, I mean, it's not like you have one target group for suicide, at risk of suicide. You have lots of different groups, right? So you have sort of rural farmers, at times of drought, for example, middle-aged men are more prone to suicide. You have young gay lads living in, say, working-class areas in north of Adelaide, some of the Peachy Belt in Adelaide, somewhere like that. You have vulnerable suicide. And you have, say, young Aboriginal guys living in the Pitjantjatjara region. These are all different target groups requiring different types of programs. And the evaluation of that was a cluster evaluation, looking to try to bring them all together in terms of what they were trying to achieve and things. And working on that. Now, the thing is, there's this concept which is called wombats in evaluation, which is a waste of money, brains and time. Right, now that is something I couldn't use in England because they don't know what wombats are over there, right? But that's fairly common, particularly if you go to a rural area and you're coming in as a high end guy doing the South Australian component of the National Suicide Prevention Strategy. And I encounter that quite a bit, that kind of attitude of, we know what works, why are you here? That sort of thing. Now the thing is, if you can get around that early on, if you can take the time to form those partnerships and work together, then clearly, some of the information which you can acquire, or even work in partnership with some of the workers to acquire, some of that information can be fed back. I mean, the program will improve as a result of it, right? I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect. There will always be some mischievous type of individual who is on for a free ride or something, who's not going to work with you. That happens. Or somebody who's been badly burned by past experiences with evaluation, who carries that burden throughout the exercise. But I mean, really the idea is, if you can work together, you will improve the program, right? Now, this is classic action research, really. This is the program is planned based on needs assessment or surveillance or whatever. They implement the program, you collect evaluation information, you feed it back, that then the program then gets revised in some ways and it carries on. You have these spirals through the life of the program. So what you end up with is a better program, but a more efficient and more worthwhile program as well. Now the thing is, I've seen some PhDs and things where people have tried to talk about implementing action research, because it's a much more rewarding thing to do, really, because you're forming relationships with people, amongst other things, and it's a more fruitful outcome hopefully at the end. But you have to really make sure that the mechanisms are built in order for that to happen, right? Because it sounds great in theory, but then this has happened, it's happened to me for sure. Sometimes, you can be feeding back information which is kind of ignored or, not really taken on board, right? So what you need to make sure is that that's pretty clear from the outset what the purpose of that approach is. So that, therefore, involves the evaluator in some capacity building exercises fairly early on, could be workshops or whatever, basically explaining what the approach is, what the evaluation is, and getting people on board with it. Right. The next thing you can do then,
I think it's a really important point that people often look at evaluation as a post activity rather than actually starting right at the beginning, and
that's
things
right.
get missed.
That's right. I mean, and that's why the topic that I teach here is called program planning and evaluation in public health. So the idea is it's to emphasise the link between the program planning and the evaluation itself, right? So one of the things you do is to try to make sure that you have the mechanisms in place to facilitate those action research cycles, right? And one of the mechanisms is to make sure that there's a some form of, and quite often these already exist, some form of reference group or critical reference group, as Wadsworth called them, right? Which is set up to help, you know, to run the program, and to for the evaluator to be part of that reference group, and to make sure that you put evaluation as a standing agenda item in those meetings. And you try and get it fairly high up in that list.
Yeah.
Because what you don't want is evaluation being right at the bottom. You come along, you raise a few points of action which could be should be considered, and people have already left, or, you know, it's all we'll pick that up in the next meeting in a month's time or whatever. Okay? But if it's early on in the agenda, people can start discussing that stuff, and that can actually start influencing how the meeting evolves,
yeah.
really.
Yeah.
And then you can get some action decisions at the end of it, so things can start to be done.
Mm.
Back to the program planning and evaluation bit, the relationship between those two things. One of the kind of fairly established or traditional ways of doing evaluation now is, I mean, it's called by different names, but really, but these are objectives-based evaluations where essentially you nut out the objectives or the changes that the program is trying to implement, okay, as opposed to the processes or the strategies or the actual work that the program's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So the objectives are things you're trying to change, and the strategies are the things that the program's actually doing, right?
Yeah.
So you nut out those objectives and you get them worded in an evaluatable form. So they're nice and clear. It's clear what stakeholders you're trying to change. And then you're trying to map the strategies, that's what the program's doing, to the objectives they're trying to change. Okay?
Yeah.
Basically. Now, some strategies will change, address more than one objective, etc. Objectives, we'll call them outcomes, because in program logic, they call them program outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, in doing that, that whole thing about identifying, you know, what the program's doing, the strategies, and what the program's trying to achieve, that's essentially program planning,
mm-hmm.
right? That's not really evaluation at all, really. It's about planning the program and making it logical and clear. And then people sometimes put these things in a program logic, where you identify what inputs are going to the program, internal and external investments into the program, what outputs and activities the program's doing, like what the program's producing, the things that the workers are doing and things. And then you have short, intermediate and long-term outcomes, which are essentially the objectives of the program. And that's a program logic, which is about the program. It's not about the evaluation specifically. Okay? But if you're working with an evaluator from the start, these things can be articulated clearly. And what that then does is that allows the evaluator to then start then identifying the sorts of indicators you need to collect in order to establish the worth and value of the strategies, and whether or not, or the extent to which, the outcomes have been being achieved or are being achieved. Okay, so you'd identify what they call process indicators for the strategies and outcome indicators for the outcomes and things. But the point is that by being involved in the start in the program planning stage, that then highlights the connections or the interconnections between the evaluation and the program itself, right? Because an evaluation plan, which sets out the indicators and the methods for collecting those indicators and what have you, overlaps with the program logic or the program plan, because the first two columns, what the program's doing, the strategies, and the last column, which is the outcomes of the objectives, are the same in the evaluation plan as they are in the program plan.
Yeah.
Okay, with the same objectives, basically. And that highlights people working together in the partnership.
Yeah.
So
how could we apply the evaluation models to education programs, either specific courses or like qualifications? And is there some methods for evaluation that are suited better to education programs?
Okay, I'll just start with a step back, really, to how we started this chat, right? And that was about, you know, the different types of evaluation, the four. Right? Now, And also overlapping with what I was saying about the action research stuff. I mean, you may remember the analogy about the blind man and the elephant, right?
Yeah.
Which is the Indian proverb, where a blind man's asked what an elephant's like. One feels the trunk and says, oh, an elephant's like a snake. One feels the tail, says an elephant's like a rope. One's on the elephant's back, says the elephant's like a boulder. And the elephant's like none of those things. What you need to do is bring all of the accounts together and they give you an idea of what the elephant's like. Okay? Now, it's the same in evaluation, really. What you want to do is to get multiple perspectives on whatever it is, a program or an education program, whatever. And so when you bring those perspectives together, when you bring those perspectives together, you get a far better understanding of what the program is, okay, and how its value and worth ultimately is the thing. Now, I think what tends to happen in education, in topics, skirting towards controversy here, but what tends to happen is that we have student evaluations of topics as quite often the only way these things are evaluated, really, apart from occasional reviews, which may happen every 2 or 3 years or something, where either internal people in the university or someone external come and look at the topic and kind of judge it from the perspective of experts, which is fine. So they have these student assessments, which tend to think, we call them here SET, student evaluation of teaching, which are anonymous surveys that students do on the web. And they send in their answers, and then these things are amalgamated to allow comparisons between courses and performances of teachers and what have you. Right. Now, the thing about it, that has strengths and disadvantages, right? I mean, I think the strength is the thing about the anonymity, because students can basically express what they really think and feel, right, theoretically. And it allows comparisons between topics and things like that, right, which is not a bad way, or not a bad way of collecting data about from the perspective of the clients, if you like, or the people coming along to courses. A big problem with that approach is that the response rates tend to be really quite poor, right? So, I know in my case, my response rates are considered really, really good, but there's still about sort of 50%, 55% response rate, really. A lot of topics, you're looking at a lot less than that, right? So that's a limitation with that approach. Another limitation, that what you tend to get is people who either kind of really... it's self-selection. You get the classic thing where people who reply either really like the topic or don't like something about it. So you get this bifurcation of response, really.
Is it really getting at whether the topic achieved what it set out to? So if we're looking at student responses of, did I enjoy it, did I not enjoy it? It's not really getting at whether it achieved the learning, though, is it?
Well, there are questions on there about learning as well,
right?
And about development, right? But they're not exams, they're not, and it gets back to this thing about what's education about, really. Is it about almost like the cup and jug model, where the educator has a jug of knowledge and they pour it into the passive reciprocal who gets the knowledge, and once it reaches a certain level, the objective's been achieved, well done, right? But of course it's not like that, right? Kind of social sciences discussions around epistemology and things, there's this idea that the nature of what reality is reality an objective thing out there, or an objective program out there to be evaluated or measured, an external truth, or is it actually a multiple truths which are co-created by the participants engaged in it, really? And I think the thing about education is it's the latter, really. What we're talking about is people, they're not passive receptacles. People come to programs with their own existing knowledges and understandings, They interact with the program and the person delivering that program, and that creates something different, something new, really. So in terms of that sort of educational thing, really, I think the person designing the program and delivering the program, it should be much more about facilitation than teaching as such, right? So it's about a bit like health promotion, really. You know, the idea of health promotion is to really to enable people to make healthier choices, and making them the easy choices to make, really. But it's all about the agency of the person, really. And I think that's the same in education. And really, what we're trying to do is, for want of a better word, cultivate learners, really, and lifelong learners, people who are going to, you know, learn how to learn, really, is the idea. Anyway, getting back to your question about how you evaluate this sort of stuff, right? So anyway, so you've got those questionnaires, which look a bit, they do ask questions about that sort of, I can't remember the wording of the questions now, to be honest, but it was something like, did the topic enhance your capacity for learning, or something like that, as one of the questions. Although a lot of them are pretty well process orientated questions, you know, was it a positive experience? You know, is Paul Aylward a good educator? That sort of stuff, right? So you have that, right? Now, but the other thing about topics as well is that, and they're introducing, or they've introduced something here, which is a peer assessment of actual teaching itself, where you can get a peer to come along and observe one of your teaching sessions, right? And then in a much more formative way, could be more than one peer, much more formative way, and have discussions about how to improve things, really. And I've certainly done that in the past when I've co-taught with other people on the same topic. It becomes more difficult in an environment where, say, if you're the only person teaching and everybody's kind of busy and, you know, that becomes more tricky, but we're certainly moving towards that way at Flinders, I think.
That's to do that. Really interesting, because in what we do, we encourage peer reviews as a way of enhancing our own practice. But I've never looked at it from the perspective as using it as part of an evaluation process.
Well, it's a part of an action research type of evaluation process, really. And so it needs, all of the issues I mentioned before around the accountability problems about suspicion and, you know, is it collegial, you know, that sort of stuff, that has to really be front and centre at the start. If you have people who are committed to improving, really, and we should all be like that, right, then it's not a big deal, really. If you have people who have it foisted upon you, oh, Joe Bloggs is going to come in and observe you and then feed the information back in an accountability way to someone else, then you're looking at a different ball game, right?
Doesn't work so well.
No. So back to this thing about the blind man and the elephant, what happens then if you've got your peers coming in and assessing things, as well as you have the sets from the students? But there's also other ways you can do it as well, because in a lot of research, we talk about triangulation or triangulating approaches in research, right? So, and that takes different forms. You know, you triangulate by the methods you use. You use different methods whereby the strength of any one method compensates for the weakness of another method, right? And a nice analogy I always use is Mary Minford, the philosopher Mary Minford's analogy of the camp, taking photographs of a mountain with cameras. And when you take a photograph from one angle of the mountain, the photograph is not the mountain, it's just a particular image of the mountain. Far better to take different types of cameras and take different angles of the mountain and get all those photographs together and look at them and get a far better idea of the mountain. That's essentially what triangulation is. You know, you can use different methods and approaches or talk to different stakeholders or blind men, so you get a far better idea of the mountain. Now, in terms of different methods, another thing that you can do is actually have conversations, or one kind of, you could be formalize it as focus groups of students around experiences of the topic and what works and what haven't. Or you can do it more informally, So you can set aside times during seminars, ideally, because semesters are so short, right? But ideally try and set those times aside to openly discuss how things are going and what's happening, purely with the aim of trying to look at what can be done better, because everything can be, nothing's perfect, things can always be improved. And it's also the case that it may not necessarily be the case that there's, you know, universal agreement on this, because things work for different people, and so, you know, and what works for one person may not work well for another. So you're always juggling approaches, really, I think. So, for example, I mean, cultural differences, right? So, students who are Southeast Asian students have done a fair bit of work with the Vietnamese community in the past. And some of those guys, culturally, they find it quite difficult to criticise someone who, say, these considered to have a degree of status, right, like a lecturer, really. So even if you invite it, you know, sometimes there's really quite a reluctance to do that, for example. And also, I think you've got to look out for things while I'm on that ticket. Look out for some cultural stuff as well, because I think some students from those sort of cultural backgrounds, they tend to be quieter, more used to more didactic type teaching styles. There's a thing called head nodding, which happens quite a bit as well. People nod their head. You can't assume that means you understand. It's more that they're saying, yes, I've heard what, I'm listening to what you're saying, more than I understand what you're saying. That sort of stuff. So you've got to be aware of that sort of thing as well. I mean, I think it's something I do. It's just kind of evaluation, but it's also just reasonable practice, I think, as well, is that I try as much as I can, because we are in an era of mass education here, is that I try to look out for students who clearly don't seem to be engaging with the topic as they should, right? And that could be through lack of attendance, lack of access on the websites, because with the corona, what's happened with the COVID at the moment is that we kind of, there's a big changes happening, lots of stuff moving online now and things, which is creating its own difficulties. But you can look to see who's been looking at the web pages and things like that. And also checking at monitoring people's performances. So someone who, say, didn't do too well in the first assignment, I try to get in contact with them and find out if there's anything happening and what can be done to improve things. But also people who do well in the first assignment and do pretty poorly in a second one, you think, what's going on here? You know? So you try and engage in that way as well, and that way you can get information not just about the circumstances of students, but sometimes you can get information about, well, actually, you know, I read this bit and I just didn't understand that at all. And then you think, oh, that needs to be, go back and revise it. So, you know, I think the thing to do is to have a degree of, a certain degree of humility, and certainly motivation, really, to deliberately seek out not just what's working well, but what's not working well. But that becomes increasingly difficult, I think, in an age of mass education, at a time when semesters are pretty short, right? You're looking at 12 weeks of teaching. Things are crammed in, students are doing other topics other than yours, right? So there's always competing demands. If it's a master's topic, students have always got other things going on in their lives. When I was a mature student for most of my studies, right? Apart from my undergrad degree, but I did two master's courses part-time. I was working full-time when I did those courses. I did a teaching course part-time, so I'm qualified teacher in schools. And I did my PhD part-time. I was working virtually full-time. So, you know, I understand the pressures of everyday life and stuff. And these are competing things. So what's ideal and what's achievable, sometimes they don't tally too well, unfortunately.
Do you look within evaluation with education, is it worth looking at grades overall from the whole cohort and from previous cohorts, comparing them? Or is there not a lot of value in that?
I think there's a value in looking at grades over different years.
Yeah.
I mean, but from a contextualized position, really, you interpret it, right? Yeah. So, for example, with COVID, COVID's changed everything, it's thrown everything in the
air,
right? So, you know, I mean, people who would ordinarily would be high flyers are not high flyers.
Yeah.
Other people who perhaps are locked in or something, experiencing lockdown, right, but don't really have a lot of other things to do. Maybe they've not got any kids or not got a job or whatever, right, can throw themselves more into study. So in some ways they can have a more, almost a beneficial fringe benefit for them there, really. I was just thinking of something else. Remind me of that question.
Grades. So
cohorts. Oh yeah, the grades.
Between cohorts and across years.
Yeah.
And
okay. So yeah. Well, I remember a while ago when I was first asked to look at taking on the program planning, well, the evaluation topic here. It was basically because of the things weren't going too well in terms of the grades for the students and things. A lot of students were failing and stuff like that, right? So I think when you have a situation like that, where, you know, clearly students are not benefiting from the topic, the grades are important, right? Crucially important, because ultimately, you know, students are here to get the grades. That's what it is. I mean, a lot of them want to grow and reach the full potential, that John Dewey sense of, you know, building the potential, reaching the potential people have, right? I'm just going to jot something down before I forget it. But the ultimately people are here to because they want the qualification, right? You can't get away from that, right? Unfortunately, right?
It's a two-edged sword.
Yeah. So, I mean, so the grades are important. Now, in terms of looking at them, as I say, you have to interpret them according to the context. See, that's also in terms of the student intake. Right? So, for example, the year that I'm referring to when I was asked to take over the topic, we had quite a lot of overseas students coming in. And I think, I don't know how it happened, but a lot of them, the level of English writing wasn't that terrific, really. So when you're dealing with certain topics, like an evaluation can be like this, where you're defining new concepts for people and then defining new concepts in terms of the previously defined concepts, this becomes very, very difficult for people for whom English is not the first language, right? And that can cause a lot of problems for people, particularly. And I'm not saying this, I'm not making any comment about the guy who's teaching it before me at all. He was a good guy and a good teacher. But it also depends on how the thing's taught.
Mm.
Right? Because of my own teaching background. I've taught primary school kids, I've taught junior schools, I've taught sixth form colleges, I've taught universities, right? And one overriding thing about what overriding message for me there really is the first thing to try and make the topic interesting as a fair and try and make it relevant to people, but also make sure that you explain things clearly, right? And if you can't explain complex, and some things, as I say, they have to be explained in terms of earlier concepts, but the idea is to really go back to the earlier concepts and build them as step, you call it scaffolding now these days, but build them as stepping stones, right? And that's the gift of being a good teacher, I think, is basically making sure that people can understand and can progress to the more complex things. And a bit, but it's difficult for people who don't have English as a first language, right? So it's the context of the, you know, the overall, what's going on in the world, like COVID, but also you look at the student intake and stuff like that. Now, there is this thing that drifts around, this idea that, you know, well, is it approximating to a normal distribution, the marks, right? And, you know, is that, because that's somehow considered the norm or something, right? No, I don't go along with that, to be honest. Because basically, if it's working well, if the topic's working well, right, then you can pull people up to be, you know, to a level where they're becoming their own agents of learning and are doing well or reasonably well in Toby. So you can do that, right? In which case you will have a positive skew in the distribution, because you'll always get a few who, for whatever reason, don't do well. Okay? So look, just looking at the marks in terms of that, you need to interpret what's happened. But there's also the case, I think, where you look at people's marks, and I've seen some things in the past, some sets of marks, and you think, these are ridiculously high, these marks, you know. In fact, I was at a meeting not that long ago where someone was talking about marks, and they said that, you know, it's not unusual for them to give marks in the high 90s, right? Now, I've never marked anything in the high 90s in my life, right? This is an almost perfect answer. I mean, you could possibly get it if it was, say, a multi-choice quiz or something, the right or wrong answers, right? So that's the my stuff I teach isn't like that. Okay. And the other thing about that is I don't see the point of it, really, because ultimately what people are looking at degree level is the classification. You know, do you have a high distinction, which are clusters of marks, right? So if a high distinction is 85, then why go much above 85? It's a high distinction or it's not. And one of the problems is because if you think about a short semester, right, and there's only so much you can cover in so many weeks, and you have to spread your assignments out a little bit. So you've got to, you know, you might do 4 or 5 weeks before you can give the first assignment. And I try and build on the first assignment, so there's actually a progressive assessment happening there. But if then someone gets, say, 99% or something in that first assignment, then they can still do extremely well if they do quite poorly on the second assignment. But the second assignment will, of necessity, include elements of learning which were not part of the first assignment, right? So in other words, in a short semester which is covering a particular academic area, it could be someone could do quite well if you mark them like that, even though chunks of that short semester learning have not been internalised or learnt.
So they're useful, but really should be used in conjunction with, you know, your own evaluation of whether, you know, how the cohort is doing, some reflection on your own performance and abilities within education and perhaps peer reviews.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that educators should look at in including in an evaluation?
Well, there's the thing about self-evaluation, right? And there's things about, well, I'm not sure that I've stressed it before, about having people look at, you know, other people, experts or whatever you want to call them, look at the structure of your topics to make sure, you know, it's comprehensive and it's been covered well. People who teach in other areas to see how you're teaching it and what the assessment's like and things. But also, I think there's also, and I think this can be a little bit overlooked until the once every 3 or 4 year external or internal review. There's also the thing about seeing where the topic fits into the broader course as well, because it's, I think you can have situations, and I'm not saying this applies here by any means, right, but you can have situations where similar things are being taught on different topics, right? And that's particularly more likely to occur when you have this kind of, more is the case where students are picking and choosing topics from completely different areas and kind of constructing their own degree, really. So you can have that. So I think it also needs that someone overviewing things to evaluate the topic in terms of where it fits in an overall course, right? So you have that. You can't overestimate the self-evaluation elements as well. So, I mean, I think all of those things come into it. Now, you can do stuff as well afterwards, which might fit into a little bit of your, the Kilpatrick results level, right? Where you can follow students up when they've left, right? But I'd see that not so much as an evaluation, as more as a piece of research, really. And that would be about, you know, seeing, well, to what extent have you actually implemented the things that you've learned here? Now, again, that can be a little bit misleading because, one, I'm not sure the response rate would be, and there'll be some response bias in there, right? But also, I think, you know, the extent to which people can actually apply stuff in their job depends on what the job is, yeah. Right? So if someone ends up being a banker, right, God forbid, then it's like, you know, the stuff that they learn on my evaluation, what are they going to do if they're a banker, yeah. Right? How are they going to do? Hopefully they'll have acquired some skills where they can be self-critical and stuff yeah. like that. But, you know, whether even they recognise that might be true.
It would be quite, I think, difficult after time to sort of separate as well what I learnt in my course as opposed to what I'm yeah. learning
yeah.
on the job and post-study as well, in way of deciding which components came from my education and which came later.
Well, there's that old Buddhist saying, isn't there? You can never untangle the circumstances which led you to this point, right? And that's true, you know, basically who you are and how you're operating in this the context of the world in which you live, and this, if you get back to that social constructionist type stuff about multiple truths and all that sort of stuff, right? I mean, it's you are on our amalgam of various experiences, and to basically say, yes, it was this that, you know, brought about this, you know, this linear causal thing, and it's very difficult to say, even though sometimes I think in social science we try to impose that level of meaning on people, try to make them say, well, did this cause this? And in fact, that's what that other approach and evaluation, the black box randomized control trial type of, that's what it's about. It's all about causal attribution, yeah. right? You know, that's its purpose.
Mm.
You know, did this input cause this outcome, right? And I think that's, you know, quite, it's an understandable thing to pursue. You know, it's not, I'm not saying it's meaningless or it doesn't have value. Of course it does, right? But it's difficult for individuals to know, particularly if it's somewhere down the track, right? So, you know, did your upbringing influence who you are now? Well, undoubtedly it did, but I'm not quite sure how, right? Yeah.
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 Just, I guess, as a way of finishing off our conversation. Now, you teach quite complex topics, and I know this because I've been in
some of them. And you're still alive. That's the main thing.
I survived quite successfully, and I did find them extremely beneficial.
Oh, lovely, thanks.
So, you know, hence why I'm here, because this would be great to share with other people as well.
Oh, lovely, okay.
But because you do teach complex subjects, I thought you might be able to give our listeners some insights, and what are some tips or ways that you can actually enhance the teaching of complex subjects? You know, you talked about before scaffolding was one technique you use. Is there anything else that could help our listeners implement in their education practice? How long
right.
the piece of string?
Yeah, that's a very tricky one to we've just been talking about, you know, that Buddhist thing about you cannot entangle. Now, because I've been doing it for so long, it's quite difficult to sort of step back and, well, actually, what you need to do with your life is, like, sitting next to some Londoner on a coach trip or something who starts telling you what to do with your life. What you ought to do, mate, is this. No, what tips I can give? Well, the first thing, right, I think, is that in your teaching, you've got to try, I mean, if you can, and I'm not saying I'm particularly good at this either, right, but I think if you can, you have to start from the premise of engaging people that you're talking to, really, because, you know, we're all human beings, right? You have to, I think, have a kind of, and I don't even know if this can be taught to people, really, but you have to have this kind of a respect for other people and their experience and their opinions, even if you disagree with them, right? I mean, I remember there was an interview with Louis Theroux one time. He said something which I thought, this is spot on, really. And he said that whenever he interviews people, he always starts from the premise that they are absolutely sincere.
Yeah.
Right? And that way, he didn't say this bit, but on that way you can get away from, or you kind of detach yourself from the us and them thing, or the, you know, potential conflict thing. It's all about, you know, exploring meanings together, really, and having that kind of respect thing happen. So that's the first thing, really. And that can involve, you know, trying to really find out. I mean, I've introduced a thing now where, you know, I get students to try and introduce themselves and say a little bit about themselves, really, at the start, in order to try to get those relationships, not just with me, but with the students together, really, to try and build a form of collegiality, really. So that might be another tip, really, that thing about, you know, getting people wherever possible. And this is tricky in the age of, you know, plagiarism, Turnitin software and stuff like that, but to work as collaboratively as you can while ensuring that people's work is their own, that they produce to be assessed, right? So if people can work together, and again, there's a challenge here with distance learning because of COVID and all that sort of stuff, then that's another way of doing things. In terms of the scaffolding stuff, now I'm always of the view, right, that what you try to do is to try to build on real life experiences in order to explain concepts, and you start off simple, right, to the point where, you know, initially you might get people in a classroom looking at each other a bit peculiar, saying, why is this Mickey Mouse stuff being taught to me, right? But nonetheless, if you do that, it means you're pulling everybody on board, because some people don't know it, right? And everybody's on board, and you can start moving people, shepherding people forward to get to levels where they're then looking at more complex stuff. And I think that's extremely important, and to make sure that you pull, bringing everybody along, really. Now, everybody along, some people are disengaged or whatever, sometimes for genuine reasons, and you may not be able to. But if you have that in mind, if you can pull people along with those simple concepts and build them. I'll give you an example, right? Because I used to teach a bit of statistics as well in the past, right? And I remember teaching people about standard deviations, probably not standard deviations, really. This is a better one, actually, levels of measurement, right? And I was explaining about and there's different levels of measurement. There's nominal, ordinal, interval, and ratio levels of measurement, right? And one of the things the students was clear when, to me, was that there's that this difficulty of understanding the difference between interval data and ratio data, right? And for all our listeners, the difference is basically this, right? In interval data, the difference between points on a scale is the same size, the same order of magnitude, they call it, or the same interval, it's the same, right? Whereas in ratio data, you have that, but there's also a ratio relationship in that. If you cluster those measures together, there's a relationship, and it's easier to explain with an example. Age is a ratio data, right? So someone who's 20 years of age is twice as old as someone who's 10 years of age, right? But and the gap between 20 and 21, that interval, is the same as the gap between 19 and 20, between 7 and 8 or whatever, right? So it's interval data and ratio data. In interval data, it's just the intervals that are the same. Okay, the gap between 1 and 2 is the same as the gap between 7 and 8, but the ratios don't apply. And the example of that would be temperature, right? So 20 degrees is not twice as hot as 10 degrees. Or even though the intervals are the same between units, 10 and 11 is the same as 11 to 12, etc., right? Now, why are you letting me talk about this? Anyway, right. The thing about that.
Because you're an educator.
Right, okay. And the thing about that. And it's just statistics. I haven't taught this for years, right? This has come into my head. But anyway, the thing about that, right, is that a lot of students find it very difficult initially, right? And I know this, right, because when I was taught it, I wasn't even. I was just basically, these are the levels of data. Bang, that's it, right? And you think, oh, okay. Well, that sounds a bit odd to me. You know, how can you have interval data where 20 isn't twice as big as 10, right? And so the way I explain that is I said it's the same for shoe size, right? So I drew a foot on the blackboard, on the whiteboard, a big foot, right? Cartoon foot. I said, there's your foot here, and then you start here. So size 1 is this interval, size 2 is this interval. But size 6 is not twice as big as size 3 because you've got to take into account this big foot I've drawn here because there's no absolute zero. The foot's in the way, right? And as soon as I'd done that, everybody knew it. And I had stats students coming up to me and saying, I've never really understood that. It's obvious. It's so obvious, right? And that's the thing. I think the thing is about even something as daft as that, you start off basically like that, and you'll know from the evaluation stuff. You know, if you look at program logic, that if-then relationship stuff, you start off, you're going for a camping trip. If we pack the car, then we can drive to the state. If we do it, then we can set up a tent. Yeah. Program logic, right? You start off simple, and then it can get more and more complicated. And if you build that kind of, or you facilitate that kind of love of learning and wanting to learn and implement stuff, then the students themselves can start making it really complicated, right? And some of the stuff, and certainly in the evaluation topic, some of the plans and program logic things, you look at them and think, this is really quite complex here. And that's, if you excuse my language, for me that is fucking great, right? Because you look and you think, shh, you can bleep that out if you like, but you look and you think, fuck, fantastic, right? They've got this, right? And they're taking this to their own levels in their own areas, to the point where I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, all right, I'd like them to explain this bit a little bit more. Hopefully they will in the assignment anyway, because ask people to provide a rationale for what they've done, right? But and it generates learning, so it actually generates learning in the person doing the teaching as well. So doing that sort of stuff, encouraging people to work on programs of their own, using examples, trying to use jokes, try to use funny examples, right? Try to use stuff from real life that's happened, as well, to sort of make sure that, you know, because evaluation could be horribly dry subject for people to teach, right? And some aspects of it, you can't get away from it. It is a little bit dry, some bits of it, right? But if you can start telling little stories about, actually, when this happened to me, this happened, right? And people relate to it, particularly if you're working, people in work, world of work, well, you're dealing with other people, other agencies and problems all the time. And it builds a degree of solidarity, I think.
I think they're really useful things, the scaffolding, concrete examples and, you know, application to real life and, you know, case studies, you know, happened to me, you know, you use those a lot. And it was really beneficial to learning, so I really appreciate you sharing those with
us. Thank you very much.
And sharing all your experience about evaluation, so thank you so much for being a guest, Paul.
That's all right, my pleasure.